Welcome to A Cult of Personality, esoteric podcast extraordinaire at occultofpersonality.net. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and my co-host is Rudolph Berger. A Cult of Personality podcast is available on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, Acast, TuneIn, and all the best podcast apps. This is episode number 178, featuring an interview with ceremonial magician Frater Ashin Chasan. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section, as well as our patrons who participate via the A Cult of Personality Patreon campaign. Although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs to produce it are significant. Your financial contributions ensure the continuity of the show. Please support A Cult of Personality by joining the membership section at occultofpersonality.net/membership or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. The Patreon page now features an exclusive RSS feed for patrons, meaning that if you subscribe there to support the show, you'll get some extra content just for you. And if you're already supporting the show or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks and I salute you. I also want to take a moment now to thank everyone who reached out to me upon hearing about my illness last summer when I talked about my dear co-host Rudolph stepping up to assist in the previous episode. Thank you to everyone who took time to reach out. I was touched by your kind words and encouragement. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Now, in episode number 178, Frater Ashin Chasan returns to the show to discuss his most recent book, the magnum opus entitled Gateways Through Light and Shadow, published by Azoth Press. Frater Ashin was our guest previously, more than 3 years ago, in podcast episode 138. Frater Ashin is a ceremonial magician and purist in the art who endeavors to recreate the workings found in traditional grimoires as closely as possible. His book, Gateways Through Light and Shadow, details his extraordinary magical evocations, detailing the experiences and teachings provided by heavenly beings. Frater Ashin's magnum opus, Gateways Through Light and Shadow, is the most extraordinary magical record that I have ever read. The evocations detailed within are nothing short of revelatory and amazing. No amount of praise is sufficient to convey the work that Frater Ashin and his scryer have accomplished in bringing through the teachings of these powerful spiritual entities. With this book, Frater Ashin has cemented his reputation as perhaps one of the foremost Western ceremonial magicians on the planet. The record he provides of his workings in this tome is nothing short of astounding. I'm proud to be able to bring you this interview and also feel humbled upon reflection about what it represents. Frater Ashin, I want to welcome you back to A Cult of Personality podcast on the occasion of your most recent book, Gateways Through Light and Shadow, published by Azoth Press. Truly a magnum opus in every sense of the word. It really is. Maybe you could take a moment just to remind listeners who might not be already familiar with you and your work, who you are, a little bit of your background and bio before we get into the book itself.
Sure. Well, I've been involved in traditional ceremonial magic and evocation. And by that, I mean replicating experiments found in the classical grimoires or books of magic that dictate the procedures of contacting various spiritual entities, whether they be angelic, demonic, or something in between, and seeing, you know, if those systems have merit, if I can actually get a spirit to appear. And for me, evocation, to be successful in what I consider in actuality, something that's really going on, is if I can perceive the spirit. Can I see them? Can I hear them? Can I have dialogue with them? If I ask them questions, I'm not just getting, you know, vague yes or no's or trying to fill in the blanks with my imagination. I can actually hear word for word the responses. I can learn something that is foreign to me, something that, you know, is new and credible information, something that, you know, I see as valuable. Also, if they're able to assist with anything, whether that be practical, esoteric, or otherwise, that they do fulfill that I do see the results of that. To me, that is an actual evocation, and that's how I practice. I've been involved in this kind of magic for a number of years now. I'd like to say this is probably going on about 15 plus years since I began really experimenting with these classical forms of magic. And through this process, where my new book entails that I'm inviting someone in, that's just not me talking, conjuring, and perceiving these spirits. It's somebody else having direct conversation, direct contact with them, and recording our findings and, you know, really evaluating those and seeing what these experiences mean for us, and if they're important enough to actually provide to other interested readers or people involved in esoteric practice, to see if some of the information, even the identity, appearance, and workings, offices of these spirits, if we can provide more useful information. And that's been a lot of my prominent pursuits in doing this kind of working. And it's ongoing. I have a room and chamber dedicated solely and only to magical practice. That is something that one way or another I'm working every day. So magic in its sense is a full-time position for me. I also create a number of magical artifacts, talismans, all sorts of things for other magicians, other people involved in esoteric practice. And I keep that going as well, which is nice. And then on occasion, there are clients who requested me to contact angelic or other beings on their behalf. They may have some questions or beseech them for certain powers of their office. And I offer that under certain circumstances as well. So my work as a magician is ongoing and pretty steady. And I consider myself very blessed, for one, that I've had the encounters and experiences that I have, and that they continue to be more dynamic and amazing all the time. And then I continue to learn and perfect my technique in those areas.
Frank Rashen, may I dig a bit further, because I'm also, I admit, on a personal level, fascinated by your path, because ceremonial magic in the more or less classical way is also something that's very close to my heart. And so, two questions regarding this. Have you always been a solitary practitioner? Have you had at any time earlier or now attachments to groups which you attend regularly? And secondly, that might sound a bit provocative, but I'm sure you get the reason for that question. Why ceremonial magic in the 21st century? We seem to become more and more exotic animals as ceremonial magicians, but why did you choose that path, and what is it that you feel so strongly for in it?
So first of all, as far as magical groups, I went through, I'd like to say, kind of a solo, you know, initiation, or I guess self-discovery of such magical lodges like the Golden Dawn and their practices, which I still implement from time to time. A lot of their rituals and such are still very valuable to me and use them. But I never felt compelled to join a lodge or join a group per se, simply because I think when I began on my magical path, there was unfortunately no one around me that I found or that I encountered that seemed to have the same experiences that I did, or to the degree that I did. I was left trying to figure out a lot of this stuff on my own. And I had a lot of time on my own to develop my scrying abilities, contact with, you know, various spiritual entities. And it just didn't seem like it was quite necessary to work in a group, even when I did spend some time trying to seek out other people, it just didn't really come together. So I never pursued that path with, you know, much passion or interest, seeming like it didn't really get me to anything that I needed. This recent book, Working with a Scryer, and doing all of these workings with someone is definitely different, but it came from someone that I actually did join a group, but not a ceremonial magic, not a hermetic group. It was actually a Druidic Celtic group that my scryer and I met, and that was the only kind of group sitting I was actually involved in, it, celebrating the Celtic holidays, reading the stories, and kind of honoring the tradition that way. So that would have been my first group type involvement, but a lot of times it was just me and my friend talking about these kind of things and being involved in these practices. So when we finally started doing traditional ceremonial magic, it worked out because he was someone that I trusted adamantly. And even Scant's magical practice, he's still one of the most genuine and honest people that I've ever known throughout the many years that we've known each other. So these things were already established. And I already knew him to be very, very talented magically, not in the same system that I became involved in, but within the Celtic aspects. So, you know, that really set a lot of things for me. And as far as what drew me to classical ceremonial magic, I think what it was is that I started becoming, with all my early encounters with spirits, with these kind of really unusual phenomenon, I knew there was something there, and I was very much disillusioned, or I guess disinterested in the modern kind of it's all in your head, you know, type, taking a swing to the completely psychological practice. And it was kind of a hodgepodge and you know, what they call the New Age system, where they're drawing from multiple traditions and cultures and spiritualities and practice, this kind of thing. And they're just kind of throwing them all in together and trying to explain everything through these kind of psychosomatic and psychological aspects. And I knew there's something beyond that. So my interest began. It's like, well, here I have this classical book of magic. It's somebody took the time to write this down. It's very detailed. And I wasn't falling for, oh, those are blinds. You know, people wrote this just so people would see it as too complicated and they would not practice it, or they put a lot of wrong things in there just so people would purposefully mess up as blinds. I'm like, I don't think so. So I was like, I would like to try this experiment without having to hear a whole bunch of modern interpretations for people who had read it but had never done it. They were just kind of theorizing. And I wanted to see, I'd like to see what would happen for me. And that's how I came about this. I was just somehow compelled to really give some of these experiments a try to see what would happen. And when I began that, I got results. And even though it's been a development, things happened enough where I knew that, okay, there's something to this. It's not just, you know, writings for writing's sake, and it's not just historic superstition. These are experiments that have, you know, some vested reasons for why they do things the way they do, how they deal with spirits. And you know, the more I studied this, the more these aspects started to make sense, and things became more successful. And there might be a part of me too that has a passion for tradition, that has a passion for the historic masters, the magicians of old, the masters of old that had these interactions and had these conducted these magical experiments in a way that were important enough to record, to write down, and to pass on in the way that they did, even though they themselves underwent naturally many versions, many alterations, you know, from magician to magician, from culture to language, and, you know, just like anything. But regardless, I find them fascinating and also veritable in practice. There's something about starting from the bedrock of these grimoires and working your way up instead of trying to assume anything that I feel personally has given me the most success. A lot of people argue otherwise, or people say they're, you know, successful doing all kinds of other things, which is fine. But this is speaking from my personal experiments and experiences in ceremonial magic.
Well, thank you for putting it so clear. I can very much relate to what you're saying. It's important how you put that so clearly and very understandably.
Yeah, that was excellent. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your devotion to the craft aspects of magic, the tools you've created, the talismans. I mean, they're all incredibly beautiful, and I imagine take a tremendous amount of skill and time. But I'm wondering how the creation of these things affects you and ultimately these magical operations.
Well, when it comes to designing and crafting the materials for ceremonial magic, and not only that, but integrating the invocations, even the wearing of robes and all of these things, I come at dealing with my own psychology. I come at the aspect of, look, do I honestly believe and do I honestly think that when I do this, I'm encountering, even if it's a fraction, a part of these emissaries, these messengers, these divine beings of ridiculous power, authority, and presence. Am I contacting them? Or is it something from my mind or something altogether? You know, what is my real purpose for doing these? And for one, ceremonial magic, even though I do use it to very, very practical ends, and I ask for assistance, just like many, this has never been my primary reason for doing these things. My primary reason is, does it work? And yes, do I believe, do I think that I'm going to be contacting these amazing beings? Well, if the answer is yes, then I'm not going to use duct tape and cardboard just because I think I'm this powerful being that can just do this and do something sloppy or try to, you know, modify or do things that's just convenient. To me, the whole practice of ceremonial magic is an immersion. It is a discipline, and it is a process of devotion. And a devotion not in the sense of trying to get all, you know, religious or spiritual that way, but it is a devotion to what I'm doing. It's taking time and the ability to the best I know how to, for one, honor the tradition that I'm, or the practice that I'm trying to do, honor what the grimoire says is important. I'm taking it seriously because I'm integrating my consciousness. Yes, I'm going to be successful contacting these beings, and I'm going to do everything that I can to do that in an honorable way, because this is important to me, and I find them important. I find the whole process of evocation something that's deserving of this time and dedication, because stuff happens. And maybe it's because I did have interactions with spirits and they did move me and they did really change my whole aspect on life. So it's not a game, and it's not something that just requires marginal effort just to get something you want. For me, it is a vocation. It is something that I've aspired to do to the best of my ability because it seems important to do so, simply for that reason. And that's, I think, where it's primarily coming from. And I try to take that kind of integrity forward in this practice. You know, and that doesn't mean every experiment has gone perfectly or successfully. And some of my earliest ones, even when I put everything in, were complete failures. But I think my ability to not abandon it and not totally take that ego blow and give up on it, but to persist and to try again and to work through, has meant more than simply the tools and the process in and of themselves. The tools and process are the result of, I think, the place within my heart, my mind, that I'm coming at this kind of practice. And I think that's where the magic starts to happen.
Fradrashen, maybe to encourage others who are also trying to be on that kind of path, where does your ability in the craft come from? How did you get there? And do you have materials that you prefer to others for internal reasons, not just for the way you are able to handle them? And has that brought you any further? I mean, I know your talismans, they are so beautiful. They look great. And you just want to have them, to be honest.
It's so funny with the making tools. I was surprised, and I'm continually, you know, honored and thankful that people find the things I've made, you know, beautiful and everything, because I think I made things as when I was in a teenager and everything, but I never took, I mean, I had shop class in junior high. That's as far as my, you know, my woodworking and making things instructions, educations went. So when I began, I guess it was an act of will. You know, before I really started getting into this stuff, I didn't really consider myself, you know, a crafts person or any kind of person with any remarkable skill in that way. I hadn't made, you know, many, many things, just a few hobbyist, you know, trinkets here and there. I had a very basic understanding of working, but I think my determination Maybe it is because my imagination and my ability to kind of figure things out when I'm really interested and focused on something just kind of led me to give things a try. And then, of course, I think I was blessed when I put my attention and my will towards that, you know, trying to get these things created, that a lot of things just happened to work out for me. I was lucky. I was, you know, guided. And, you know, some of these things that I was trying to figure out just happened to fall into place. Thinking about the pedestal from drawing spirits into crystals, it's, you know, kind of a complex mechanism in a lot of ways, trying to get a crystal to set inside of a relatively small plate and then have that plate set in a piece of ebony or something and getting it to where it's not going to fall out or that it looks like something that can be used. It's just something that I kind of went towards and it worked out. And then as I made more and more implements and people asked me to make them for me, I got better with each one. I was able to figure out better and easier ways to do that, more successful ways to make these things. And just like anything, it's a learning process, but I can't really credit anything else besides just kind of my determination to make them to the best of my ability.
Frater Ashen, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your attitude, demeanor, sort of the view you're approaching the work with, because you talked about your devotion and you have an amount of humility that's discernible, despite your incredible attainments, I think. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the way you approach all of this a little bit more.
Sure. Well, you know, that's an excellent question because it's something that I run around in my own mind again. And anybody I've spoken to, I'd like to say that, you know, I'm more humble and I should be a lot more humble when it comes to magical things. Sometimes online, everything, I've been known to bicker, you know, be kind of petty sometimes when, you know, people arguing. That's something that I definitely have to work on. But getting into the deeper work, when I'm in the right place in my mind and I don't get distracted, to be honest, after this working, after these encounters with these archangels and these beings, it's been so dynamic that my ego really did have to decrease. And then my idea of service and actually doing this for reasons beyond my own financial or other practical security, even though it's continually, I mean, it's well supported that way without having to conduct, you know, all these workings just to maintain. It's been a real big blessing. But there's been extreme discovery. Both me and my scryer, we each go through it individually, but we come together to talk about it. About the angels were gracious enough to, you know, provide us with all this information, but it would really boil down to, you know, what are you going to use this beyond your own benefit and, you know, your own amazements and appreciation? You know, how's this going to serve beyond yourselves, beyond your families? And it's a huge ongoing process for me, and it directly relates to my involvement in seminary and to my involvement within the church that I'm associated with, which has been unbelievably supportive and completely in line with my magical working, to the point where I'm never in doubt that those two paths have worked together to kind of help guide me on the way that I need to go. And, you know, without getting religious, it boils down to, of any tradition, of any persuasion, that when you're in power and if you are connected to these amazing things, it really does open that question of, you know, if your spirit's full, if your heart's full, then, you know, you got to give that to other people. You got to get through your own turmoils and your own hurts and whatever that was. And even with people who disagree with you and everything, how can you bring that forth? How can you give blessings instead of causing problems, you know, for people? How can you make the world better instead of just being another person in it and doing your own thing? And it really does boil down to that. And I'm challenged with that. And I'm also gracious because of that fact that becomes recurring, because it is very prominent in my heart and mind because of these workings, because of the ongoing blessings that we do receive. I try to take it upon myself to do better, to use this working even beyond just intellectual stimulation and curiosity for people, but hoping that, you know, these writings and these words and other things that I do are seriously helping people to get to that same point, to get to whatever they see as as being a fulfilled and joyous life for them. And hopefully with this continued work, I can achieve those ends much better and be into service, because that's what it's really boiled down. If I'm able to achieve those ends, then I'll be doing the right work.
Listening to how you describe this feeling of devotion, humility, but also I hear will and a certain kind of power to achieve what you are achieving. It reminds me a bit, I'm in the performing arts, and I had a teacher who once told me, look, when you're on stage and doing something, a role or a song, whatever, you have to think there's nobody else at that very moment who can do it just as well as you do. And then when you are finished and go back into your dressing room, you have to find that devotion again and know how good or not so good you really were. Is the feeling that you describe a bit comparable to such a situation, or am I completely on the wrong track here?
No, I kind of like how you put that. And I guess if I would compare it, when I'm in the midst, you know, right, of course, during and then after, for quite a long period of times, like through some of our bigger interactions with these amazing beings, the sense of who they are, and I guess kind of that being connected to the source, being where there's no questions, there's no worries, there's no doubt in your mind that, yes, this did happen. Yes, there's this higher power. Wow. Yes, it's beautiful and amazing. It permeates and it goes through every ounce of who you are. And it brought myself and my scryer to tears many, many times. It's the most amazing feeling in the world. It would be compared to being up on stage. There's nothing else higher. There's no other moment that is more important or more direct and is beautiful. And then as that, you know, we go back to our jobs, we go back to, you know, still human, dealing with taxes, work, and everything else that everybody has to deal with. Enough time goes on where you miss that. Then there's just sort of questions, or even after these amazing instructions and support that you've been given, myself, speaking for myself, you do something stupid. You argue with someone, or you do an action that's totally in line with everything that you've been given there, and that the most amazing feeling. And, you know, you try to reason or rationalize it out and everything, but it makes things difficult, and it doesn't, I don't know if it's so much about ego and everything, but it kind of like, okay, I've been given this amazing thing and stuff. Like, what am I doing? I have those kind of points where I have to think, you know, am I really this good? Or am I really deserving of this? I guess is what it boils down to. Or am I really acting in the persona of someone who is allowed to do this kind of work, that does do this work? And that's something I think that gets on me, and that I kind of come back to myself, and it's like, hey, they're talking about service. Are you serving right now? Like, what are you doing? I'm having this dialogue with myself. And I think that's where it really gets humbling, when I have to really snap myself back out of getting distracted or getting off on a stupid tangent and really focusing on, like, you know, this is important stuff, and you've pretty much been prompted. You've got to go out and do this, and you should be serving, helping, doing something that matters with this, you know, not screwing around. And I think that is where that I'm back in my dressing room talking to myself. Those are the conversations that I have, yeah. If that makes any sense.
Of course, yeah. Thank you.
I'm wondering if we could delve into the book a little bit more. I mean, if you'd be willing to sort of just give people a high-level overview of the different types of evocations that you record, because they're fascinating and they're extremely different in many ways.
Sure. I think when I brought the book together, and since it's how I recorded it, I really wanted to give the reader a glimpse of some very important years of my life doing the magical work, and kind of a level of progression, not only for myself, but of my scryer, who was brand new to this kind of ceremonial evocation. And what happened was, it began with an experiment that I was using in hypnosis and kind of doing this astral projection formula that I describe in the book, where I had all of the assumptions that he was going to contact one of his Celtic deities, or maybe even an ancestor or something, but it ended up being an angel. in one that we had not heard of before, but later found. And the angel was very adamant that we begin doing magical work together. And it just seemed, because I was right in the midst of doing these experiments right after my first book, I was ongoing, that I was like, you know, it would be perfect to take him in this because, one, I really do think he'd be able to see something because of his own ability if we do this regardless. And two, I'd really like to get his experiments because, you know, he's not a trained hermetic magician. He doesn't have these archetypes and ideals already set in his head about what a spirit of Mercury is supposed to look like or this archangel or anything. So it would be really neat to get something as authentic as possible and just see what happens. And so when he agreed and he seemed pretty excited, I surmised that I should take him a little bit through the initiation, so to speak, that I took myself through regarding the elemental realms, kind of establishing those archetypes both intrinsically and, you know, understanding them in this exoteric way as well. And so we did these. The first part of the book is exploring the elemental realms using this formula I kind of use, combining opening by Watchtower and some very kind of Golden Dawn traditional rituals, as well as scrying techniques and hypnosis, in fact, to get him to this point where he was basically immersed in these elemental realms. And those ended up being fascinating. And not only that, but pretty amazing things would happen and occur right after we did these kind of things that I recorded later and that I just found to be quite interesting as things went on. And so we went through the earth, air, fire, water, not in that order. But afterwards we did spirit, I guess, as kind of this fifth element. But for spirit, it was more of a practice in necromancy where somebody inquired if we could find out these hauntings that were occurring in a hospital and hospice. All these patients and even the nurses kept on seeing these children, these ghost children. They didn't know what they were about. They didn't know if it was real. And that experiment where we contacted these beings, and it was a combination of scrying but also astral travel, and it was really dynamic and one of the first times that we both got to see the same being directly. As I mean, we described the same thing, we could see the same thing in the mirror, and that was really cool. And then going on for that, when it seems like we went through those initial experiments and they were really successful, we began evoking the classical planetary archangels, like the ones I described in my first book, Gateways Through Stone and Circle. And I was really excited to see how he would perceive, if they would, you know, tell him the same kind of things as they told me, or if it would be totally different. We started doing those as frequently as we could. And the findings and the amount of information coming through were incredible, where I did my best to try to write down by hand the first experiment. It was just way too much information. So I decided to go a little non-traditional, and I brought in an audio recorder just so that I would not misinterpret or forget to write down some of the information that was coming across. I wanted to get everything word for word. It was just so incredible. So I started recording every single experiment. And after transcribing, you know, listening and making sure I got everything typed down correctly, it was, you know, 10 plus pages of information for each archangel. And the encounters were just amazing. And both of us, me kind of going through a separate one, and then my scryer kind of going through his first one, definitely kind of initiation, being in contact with these archangels. There's kind of a permeation, something about them that kind of goes through us, that instills itself in us. So it seemed like it gave us access. We were able to do more, that the next archangel would be clearer. And then when we went to the, what I call the super celestial angels of Uriel, of Sandalphon and Metatron, these really amazing, you know, very, very powerful archangels that we were, you know, able to actually get some viable contact, even though with some of them it kind of bordered on what we could even handle. Even after the previous experiments, there was a couple times where both he and I nearly lost consciousness and nearly passed out just through their presence, the flood of information, the kind of things that were coming across that was just a little bit too much for us to handle. Mm-hmm. But we did make it through. Probably the highlights, of course, was the four kings, these beings that are given different names but alluded to in nearly all of the classical grimoires of evocation, you know, the Keys of Solomon and the Gaoetia, and, you know, Heptameron, all of these really alluding to these four ruling beings and such. And there's academic debate on which names were correct and which direction and what they were really about, what they did. So contacting them, even though we really, we had some challenges because the first couple ones weren't as successful as we wanted, and we had to go back redoing it, you know, with different articles as such. And but when we finally went through it, that was, I think, personally for me, a huge breakthrough, and opened up. I mean, talking about gateways, their allowances to contact any beings from that point on was incredible. And then beyond them, probably the biggest highlight for me was Hiram, was my house spirit, the spirit that I conjured into a skull and who I speak with every single day. He's not 2 feet from me right now. It's probably the most incredible magical accomplishment, even though it's not really on my end since I think he does more, but to have an advisor, to have a spirit that I don't have to go through lengthy ritualistic ceremonies in order to even contact and to see and to hear clearly, but is there at a moment's notice, who doesn't just help at esoteric and magical things, but all things practical, even with my family and mundane things. My wife absolutely loves him and is always talking about us, forever grateful because of the information, because of the assistance that he has offered in every single aspect of my life and the things that he points out that I would have totally missed otherwise. I have a magical tutor and advisor that I can go to now that is just amazing. He's never provided information that was just not extraordinarily helpful and meaningful. And even though it's been a few years now, I mean, it's just one of those things that when I sit down and think about it, it's still one of the most amazing things for me. It began as kind of like, oh, it'd be neat, you know, to have this. That would be cool, magical thing to have, you know, spirit in a skull I could talk to. And I kind of, you know, imagine what that would be like. But it's been such an asset that I can't imagine my workings without it. It's just such a benefit. That it's hard for me to put into words what it's like to have something like that in your life, especially during times of uncertainty, times when, you know, decisions and everything, and you're looking for expert counsel, and to have that just there is beyond any kind of wealth or assistance in life that I can think of at this point. And I think that's been a huge, huge thing for me magically and mundanely as well in all aspects of my life.
Yeah, it's really profound.
Could you maybe let us know how this process around Hiram and the skull started? Where did it come from to you? Or is that too intimate, too difficult to explain?
No, the entire process, I think, would take me a little bit too long. But the first time I came upon it, I have a book on necromancy, I think by, it's like Martin Coleman or something. And the first time I kind of became intrigued was, it talked about like the witch Endor and everything, and to, you know, to speak for King Saul is kind of like a biblical thing, that it was an ode, that was an ancient kind of Hebrew, probably in other cultures as well, but way of speaking to the dead or speaking to a spirit who could assist you that was in that other world, was they resided in a skull. That was how the information, and at first kind of seeing that on the outside, it just seemed kind of maybe kind of spooky, a little macabre, but, you know, kind of interesting. And it wasn't until, you know, I got Hiram afterwards and I started asking him questions and everything. And I think one time I was like, so why a skull, you know? And he just explained very simplistically. It's like, well, you know, when you're speaking to a spirit that, you know, doesn't have a regular form, something that you're looking at, he's like, especially anciently, he's like, the skull makes sense because it looks like a human's face. You know, you get eyes and mouth and you have a focus for a human being that recognizes, you know, even though it's bone, another human being, and conversation and kind of connecting and speaking towards something that way makes a lot more sense than it would, like, you know, if the spirit was just in a pot or something other inanimate, where there's always that part of your brain that is like, you know, I'm speaking to, you know, a man-made object, you know, this kind of thing. And, you know, he kind of explained it practically that way. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But beyond that, of course, I definitely a fan of novels and even, you know, fantasy, magical things. And I became a fan of the Dresden Files, and they even had a show, and then, you know, the books and everything. And I was like, oh, Bob the Skull. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. You know, that would be, you know, that would be awesome to have. And it was after I'd read this thing, but, you know, I just wondered if, you know, he must have done his research there. I wonder where he got it from. But, you know, regardless, I'm like, there's got to be a way to do this. So I really started doing a lot of research, and I contacted a friend that I have that is an expert in Hebraic magic and ancient sources as well as modern. And through the collaboration and going through some various sources, I found a way of, if I could contact a spirit first, because I'm like, I'm not going to put a spirit in a skull who does not choose to be there. I'm like, I'm not going to trap that and then have it in my room. I'm like, regardless if it's trapped, I don't think it's going to be that helpful. So I wasn't going to do that. But I wanted to find a spirit. I was like, if I have the sigil and then I have all of these other methods and things to make the skull a binding and a protective vessel where it could reside and this kind of thing. Then I, you know, I started coming up with that formula, and it's in the book, and I think I put it in pretty good detail. But finding Hiram, it came about because we found him and because he agreed and because it's amazing. And it was an astral voyage, first through my scryer, contacting these, using these techniques that a very excellent lady that I have a lot of profound respect for in the magical community. Her name is Josephine. Through her works, there is some spirit travel techniques that worked extremely well, not only for my scryer, but for myself. And we were able to contact Hiram. And it was funny because neither one of us, it was kind of embarrassing because Hiram was a name that I was not familiar at all with. I'm not a Mason. I didn't even know the name was connected to Masonry when it happened. I'm like, Hiram. I was like, that's an interesting name. And I didn't know I should even be more knowledgeable in biblical lore, but it was just not a name I was familiar with. And my scryer had no idea either. But the spirit was just very direct, able to be very seen and interacted with very easily, as if, you know, our abilities and everything didn't have too much to do with it. And it was just such a profound meeting. And he agreed for whatever reason to come into the skull and assist me. And I was very wary because I'm like, you know, I don't know. And then even when we found the name out, I did research. I'm like, Hiram, I'm like, what? You know, the king or the of Tyr, the, you know, possible the, you know, the builder of a key summon. I was like, for me, because I'm always questioning, I didn't expect anything, you know, a spirit of any kind of fame or notoriety and everything. I was very skeptical about it. And before I did anything, I contacted one of the archangels. And I'm like, I need to know the truth of the spirit. You know, is this thing a trickster? Is it something evil, something you need to be aware of? And it says, no, this is the spirit that you read and that you think about, and you need to do this to make sure it happens and everything. So, you know, take it seriously. And I was like, okay, I was like, I can either, you know, argue the fact with the angel in this encounter or go through with it. And Hiram was very insistent. He's like, you know, when you do this, I will prove myself to you. This is going to happen. You're going to have a challenge come up lately. And true to his word, he was a tremendous asset for that. But every single time, issue, problem, what I have, he has always, always, always been extremely helpful, extremely positive for every aspect of my life. I still am surprised about it, and I still don't quite understand how or why, even though I went through the magical procedure as I did. It still seems a little bit too amazing to be deserving of what has happened as an account of these workings, because the benefit has far outseated any kind of working that I did to make this happen.
That's really, really amazing. I could ask you questions about Hiram all night long, I think. But there's so many other subjects to touch on here, and our time is short. So, oh, thank you. It is truly a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. I'm so glad you came back on the show, and I'm, you know, thrilled to spread the word about Gateways Through Light and Shadow from Azoth Press. Again, brilliant book. Rudolph, obviously, I think if nothing else has convinced people, you know, how valuable this is. If someone is practicing ceremonial magic or interested in the tradition, this is a must have. I think there's no other way to put it. It's a must have.
It's a must Definitely. Have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'd like to echo Rudolph's sentiment too. I mean, your humility is notable, and mostly because it's in a normative way, kind of directly in opposition to the attainments and things that you've accomplished, which is not typical. So, and that's why I think it's notable. So I just want to say thank you, and keep doing what you're doing, because you are shining a light out there for many, many people.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Rudolph and I continue the interview with Frater Ashin Chasan, detailing some specific teachings from an archangel, his magical advisor, and details about the Olympic spirits available only in his book. Don't miss that amazing recording. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership or patreon.com/occultofpersonality and sign up if you haven't already. By doing so, you'll support the podcast while receiving access to a tremendous amount of additional exclusive content. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.